the next topic I got was cell differentiation and apoptosis. And I thought, well, that narrowed it down. So I just thought I would concentrate on cell differentiation in terms of cell, and I again hate to use the word interactions in development. So cells interact with one another and they interact with their environment. And this interaction, either cell to cell or cell matrix, cell environment, turns pathways on and off. And these pathways being turned on or off are important for proliferation, differentiation, and apoptosis. And all these three major events are crucial to development from the embryonic stage, the fetal stage, and to you right now sitting in this chair. So all three are crucial for development, and that's why I thought I would focus more on development sort of as a broader topic rather than just differentiation or apoptosis. I give this to my very preliminary biology 2 students. Eventually we get down to the point of cell of human development. And I start off by just saying, look, we fertilize an egg. Sperm and egg meet, you form a zygote. The zygote travels along the oviduct and eventually hits the uterus where it's going to implant. But along that way, you start the very first stages of early embryonic development. Up until about a week, you get through just very defined stages that are the result of simple mitosis. The fertilized egg, which is a zygote, divides into two cells divide into four, the four cells divide, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, until about, I think, about 5 days or so, you end up with something called a marula, which is just the same. You'll notice that it's the exact same size as the fertilized egg, but it's just a ball of these little teeny tiny cells. But something really cool happens between this stage and about a week. The cells, selective cells, begin, I'm sure, to undergo cell death. Certain cells, again, begin to proliferate. And what you end up with is this hollow ball of cells, an embryonic stage called the blastocyst. This is about a week after fertilization. What it is it's a hollow ball of cells of very distinct cell types. When you look at the blastocyst, you basically end up with a blastocyst cavity. You get a bunch of these little teeny tiny cells at one end, and it is surrounded by another distinct cell type. The surrounding cells are called the trophoblast cells. These are going to specialize into a tissue called the trophectoderm, and that's going to result in your extra embryonic membranes, things like the placenta, the chorion, the amnion, that are responsible for implanting and connecting the embryo to the uterine wall. But what we're interested in as stem cell biologists, if you're a stem cell biologist, is particularly this mass. And this is a group of cells called the inner cell mass. This is the source of cells for the derivation of embryonic stem cells, or as I call them here, ES cells. Now this little thing right here is the source of all the controversy. Basically, this group of cells here. Because ES cells are said to be totipotent. They have the ability to specialize or differentiate into all cells of the embryo. I derive embryonic stem cells from the inner cell mass. I can make them form nerve, skin, bone, muscle, cartilage, lung, heart, everything in our body. That little thing, huh? Basically, what happens in the next embryonic stage is that this inner cell mass containing the embryonic stem cells begins its first real specialization event, and it forms something called an embryonic disc. This embryonic disc actually divides the blastocyst into two chambers, the yolk sac, which becomes a primitive blood-forming organ, the amniotic cavity, which will suspend the fetus. And this embryonic disc then specializes further to form three distinct germ layers. And these are the germ layers that you may read about when you're talking about, when you're interested in learning about embryonic development or embryogenesis. Three germ layers that they form are ectoderm, mesoderm, and endoderm. And from these three germ layers, all our tissues are derived. From the ectoderm, we would have the derivatives of things, our skin and our nervous system. From the endoderm, things like our lungs, our intestines, our internal organs. And from the mesoderm, a lot of our connective tissues, bone, cartilage, muscle, blood. The formation of these three marks the embryonic stage called the gastrula. Now, the germ layers are, again, populated by stem cells. But these stem cells are thought now to have not the same, what we call, potency profile as embryonic stem cells. So that the, and I say this is possible, I'm sure, this is not written in stone, that the stem cells that are found in the ectoderm have a propensity or a tendency form neural and skin tissues. The mesodermal stem cells found in the developing embryo have a tendency to form the connective tissues like bone and blood and cartilage, and the endodermal stem cells would form maybe things like liver. This restriction in lineage, if you let everything go normally and you let these stem cells differentiate into what they have, this restriction of lineage, these stem cells are called pluripotent stem cells. So again, the idea of a totipotent stem cell, which would be an embryonic stem cell, you allow a little further embryonic development, and perhaps these totipotent stem cells lose potency or the ability to form specific lineages. They become more restricted. We call them pluripotent stem cells. The problem with stem cells and differentiation now is that I don't think there's any one good definition of what a stem cell is. What's a stem cell? Anybody got an idea? Because I don't. It's a very personal thing. My own personal definition of a stem cell is a cell that has the ability to form cells of two or more germ layers. That's, to me, what a pluripotent stem cell is. A multipotent stem cell would only form cell types within one lineage. But you guys, as you read about stem cells, may get a different definition or may have your own distinct belief as to what a stem cell is. Now, we tie this into the previous seminar by saying that interactions between signaling molecules produced by these germ layers and with the developing matrix within these developing tissues results in very specific events. We call this tissue patterning or embryo patterning. So I wanted to just talk about this because this deals with cell signaling. Patterning basically requires the exposure of cells to a succession of signals and subsequent activation of those signal pathways. And if you get certain pathways turned on at certain times in certain cells, they're going to differentiate to one fate. If in a different stem cell population you turn on another pathway, they're going to develop into a different or differentiate into a different fate. So cell differentiation and the fates that these stem cells take on, signal transduction, absolutely vital. And it's only recently that researchers are now starting to look at signal transduction cascades that underlie differentiation of stem cells. It's actually relatively a new area. Now, one great example, actually, I put up here is out of the Lotus textbook. The idea of cellular interactions and the concept of induction. These germ layers develop and they start producing signaling molecules that not only affect their germ layer, but affect other germ layers. So, for example, the ectoderm will produce signaling molecules that affects the development and patterning of the mesoderm. The mesoderm begins to produce signals that may affect the patterning of the endoderm. This is the idea of induction. And this interaction between the germ layers can affect their differentiation paths. A great example is they took a developing embryo here. They took out, I believe this is a frog embryo, and they took out what is the optic vesicle. This is a very primitive tissue that eventually will form the eye. And if they took it off here, you notice that there was no development of what is called the optic cup, a very primitive, the primitive eye. But if they shoved it on this side of the embryo, they could form a well-developed left optic cup. So again, the idea of interaction between two tissues, that you can induce the formation of a tissue in an area that you wouldn't ordinarily see it in. And we've all seen these studies where some guy decides to grow a leg out of the back of a frog. We've all seen it. They do embryonic manipulation, they take a tissue type and they put it in an entirely different location, but because of signaling and induction pathways, that development takes place normally. I hate those studies. I really honestly do hate those studies. It tells us a lot of what goes on in embryonic development, but what are you going to do with a frog with a leg in its back? I mean, come on. That seems cruel to me. So embryonic development is a series of inductive events. A series of events of cell signaling, cell-to-cell communication between one cell type and another cell type. And it is this cell-to-cell communication that determines its differentiation fate. And this cell-to-cell communication could be soluble growth factors, but it could also be cell-to-cell adhesion. Maybe an ectodermal cell and a mesodermal cell making a physical connection with one another induces one cell type to assume one lineage, and the other cell type to induce another lineage. When you're talking about embryogenesis, the developing matrix is also crucial to the formation of an embryo. So it's not just soluble growth factors and hormones. Primarily in embryogenesis, you're looking at physical interactions. between cells and with the matrix that turns on very specific pathways. Now, the embryonic development can either result in maybe a choice. Two cells interact with one another. One cell becomes this fate. The other cell becomes that fate. Or you subject one cell to a particular growth factor. And if it's there, it goes to this fate. And if it's gone, it goes to the other fate. These are called binary inductive events. And it all depends on the signaling pathway that's turned on. There's also other types that are called gradient and relay types of inductive events. And again, it's basically the same idea. Gradient and relay are deal with multiple cell fates. In a gradient, you have multiple cell fates. And all depending the level of signaling you get will determine a fate. So it's not just the presence of a signaling cascade, but it's the actual level that the signaling takes place. We'll give one fate over another. In relay, you get a cascade. And again, this is the idea of proximity and distance. In a relay induction cascade, you get a cascade that will determine a fate in proximity. And then that cell goes off, and it determines the fate of another cell in proximity to it, and proximity to it, and so on, until eventually you end up with one fate here and an entirely different fate at another area of the embryo. So the idea of spatial distribution comes into play with relay inductive events. So all these things that we learn about signal transduction, embryologists have to take into account. Now, I just put up here the TGF-beta superfamily. This is one of the more well-characterized growth factor superfamilies. It's studied in cell differentiation. It's studied in proliferation. It's studied in embryogenesis. The TGF-beta superfamily is basically made up of your TGF-beta isoforms, your BMPs, things like activin. Some of the BMPs that you may be familiar with are BMP2 and BMP4. These guys play a wide role in development. They mediate proliferation of stem cells, and they can actually determine cell fate. BMP4 is known to be an inducer of mesodermal cell fate. So there are a lot of studies out there now that are determining or looking at how the BMP and TGF-beta signaling pathways control cell fate decisions and lead to differentiation of one fate over another. We've got multiple homologs in all sorts of vertebrates. Basically, it's a simple cascade. Again, it's a simple pathway, a simple signaling pathway in which, say, the TGF-beta binds onto a receptor that activates the receptor. The receptor then interacts and activates an adapter protein called a SMAD. That SMAD will then activate another SMAD, and maybe they'll form a complex. And then it'll enter the nucleus, and it will activate yet another SMAD, and that SMAD will go on and activate gene expression or turn gene expression off. So again, it's a simple cascade of boom, boom, one, two, three, four, and then eventually a cellular result. But there are a lot of adapter proteins that can fine-tune this pathway, and it is this fine-tuning that results in, say, the induction of neural tissue over the development of mesodermal tissue. So in the embryo, it's not only the fact that you turn on these pathways or turn off these pathways, but it's how you fine-tune the signaling levels in these pathways that can determine cell differentiation and determining one fate over another. There are all sorts of other signaling pathways out there. Some of the other ones that are studied, the hedgehog pathway. Initial studies, a lot of these studies were done in Drosophila, the fruit fly. The hedgehog pathway. The hedgehog pathway is known to be involved in controlling differentiation and determining cell fate in local tissues. So patterning of local tissues rather than on an embryonic scale, you'll get a patterning of, say, lung epithelia and associated tissues. We got all sorts of homologs now characterized in vertebrates. You may have heard of sonic hedgehog. Indian hedgehog, these are the vertebrate homologs of hedgehog that was initially determined in Drosophila. Wingless, wint invertebrates, patched, smoothed, disheveled. I mean, there's all sorts of names.
Do you know how the hedgehog man appeared?
I don't really know, actually. I think, a lot of these studies, let me just say, a lot of these studies were done in Drosophila. And what they would do is they would knock out these genes, and they would get a physical appearance of the Drosophila. So they would knock out one gene, and they saw that the wings took on a hairy appearance. So then they called that gene hairy. Or it took on another kind of appearance. So it probably came from a physical manifestation after knocking this gene out. I don't know where they get their names from. But you want to know how ridiculous this gets? I mean, there are the stupidest names out there. And if you study this kind of stuff, there are dumb things like brachyury, goosecoip, toll. Spetzel is personally my favorite. Spetzel, cactus, these are all the various names here that are ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. So when I turned around and looked at this cell differentiation, yeah.
They got mad at you.
No, this is it. I thought, when I sat down in front of my computer to write this, I thought, what in God's name am I going to talk about for cell differentiation and apoptosis? I really have no idea. So then I thought, why don't I let you guys dictate what you want to talk about? So that's why I'm just going to say, you know what, we got lunch in 25 minutes. Why don't we just throw it open to questions? I can't give a lecture on cell differentiation because I can tell you all about my work. I can tell you all about the differentiation of my cells. I can tell you all about the differentiation of adipose-derived stem cells to form bone, cartilage. I can tell you about specific pathways and genes that are involved in bone differentiation, but I don't know how that works well with what you guys want to do. So I thought, you know what, let's just figure it out right now. What do you guys want to know about cell differentiation? How does it affect your fields?
Basic principles.
Basic principles.
Just basic
principles. Sure, we'll get to that.
One example? Even
well, let's answer this question first, and then we'll...
I was just going to say, Charlie Little will be here to represent himself in a couple of weeks. But he would always like to add, when there's a discussion of cell differentiation, that besides the signaling mechanisms that you mentioned, which are critical, it's very important to remember that cells move during embryogenesis.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that signaling happens can be very much influenced by the fact that cells often don't stay in the same place.
Well, the best example is the neural crest.
Right.
Neural crest cells will migrate out through the primitive streak in the neurula and will actually go on to form various tissues in certain areas, and then you get induction of those tissues into here and here. So what do you mean by basic principles?
Just for those of us that have very little bio background,
mm-hmm.
if you had to summarize just the most general principles that govern differentiation, aside from the detailed biochemistry,
yeah.
are there any sort of macroscopic ways of looking at it? Let me tell you
from my point of view. I'm a molecular and a cell biologist, and I work with cells in a dish. So I stick them in a dish, and I surround them with media. And I say to myself, okay, I want to differentiate these towards bone. I know that if I add to my culture media a cortisol, a steroid-based growth factor called dexamethasone, if I add that to my cells in combination with a source of phosphate and ascorbic acid, which promotes collagen synthesis, I'm eventually 35 or 42 days down the road going to get a cell that is going to produce a bone-like matrix. In other words, it contains calcium. And it's going to upregulate its expression of alkaline phosphatase, which is a bone-specific enzyme. So I know that as a cell culturist, if I add these growth factors,
mm-hmm.
I can induce differentiation. But I also know that I can modify this differentiation if I simply coat my dish with collagen 1. And what I end up doing as a biologist, I give them various growth factors, and then I look for gene expression. Now, when you're working in vitro, that's a problem. In vitro, we put it on a dish, we add differentiation factors, and we see, oh, okay, this gene went up and this gene went down, and I'm making a calcified matrix, and this enzyme goes up, aha, I've got bone. Great. The next step is to take those cells and put it into an animal and have it do the exact same thing. And that's the problem we're hitting right now. I can make my cells look like nerves. I can get my cells to upregulate a neural gene that are very specific to neurons, synaptophysin. Is a synaptic vesicle protein that you find in neurons that actively secrete neurotransmitters. I can get my cells to express them. But can I take my stem cells and put it in a nerve defect and get it to grow a neuron? No. And that's the problem.
Do you have, just for the first part, because the second is, I think, maybe outside the scope of the conference, do you have movies you could show us where we can sort of watch as these cells grow? Because a lot of us have some interest in pattern formation or something.
Oh, yeah,
we might be able to see that maybe you're not even concerned with. But
no, I don't. But there are some people who do. They put time lapse.
Can you go to Dan Keyhart's website?
Sure.
That's fine, because he has a couple of movies on there about this dorsal closure.
I love those movies. I mean, I've when I, the last conference I went to, the one group, I can't remember their group, they actually did,
No.
No?
No? Well, I just pressed yes. I had a 50-50, what's his website?
Just an NT, Duke, Duke EDU and then PR.
Duke.
Dot Duke dot EDU. And then search for PR.
Oh, okay, alright, I'll just do that. I've seen groups where actually they put time lapse, and you can watch these cells crawling across the dish towards one another.
Yeah.
I was like, that is so cool. Anyway.
Maybe PR.
How do you spell his name?
K-I-E-H-A-R-T. So he was a lot of the same.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, whatever. I'm just saying yes every time I get these things. Alright, what do
we got here? I don't see any old
keyhard lab page. Alright. So now, I guess I've the interest, let's
there
see.
You go. The one on the left. The first one.
Dorsal.
Well,
first, what do we see there before we see?
It's time lapse of morphogenesis during dorsal closure.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll say it on the desktop. They're going to wonder what it is. So I guess, let me ask you this. Why would, from your perspective, why would you be interested in looking at cells? I look at cells on a dish and I say, oh yeah, they proliferated. No, they didn't.
Well, because I know in terms of, say, cell differentiation, at least the crowd that I'm familiar with in physics or math, the tools that we have are not necessarily at the level where you can address every single on and off signal.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't, that method
right.
of description doesn't even square away with the tools or some of the modeling abilities we have. So I'm familiar with some other work where people try and understand the morphology involved,
okay.
or macroscopic variables like the surface tension that may be involved, the viscosity of the fluid, the
right,
flow
right,
pattern,
right, okay, yeah.
Something that is so coarse-grained, but at least it gives mathematicians a
well,
handle on how to describe what they see, even if they can't predict all of the events that are to occur.
I know when we deal with tissue engineers and we deal with scaffolds mm-hmm. and things like that, we're dealing with the idea of bulk flow rates,
mm-hmm.
and you've got some of the some groups that if they want to introduce, or they want to induce differentiation, will use bioreactors.
Mm-hmm.
So that, again, you have macroscopic conditions,
yeah.
the macroscopic environment, which you always have a continuous flow of media through these cells,
mm-hmm.
which promotes differentiation.
And one of the other, sort of just personal interests, is for many years, Malcolm Steinberg,
mm-hmm.
I don't know personally, but I've read a lot of his papers, I know he had difficulty in advertising his work and trying to understand cell differentiation from using variables like surface tension,
yeah.
surface tension gradient. And, but that was the, I said, that's easily digestible for the community that I come from.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know what controversies did his way of looking at things induce, or why wasn't that way of looking at cell differentiation popular? Because that is it's a more
yeah.
natural language for us.
I think it's going to become more popular because I think as we start to understand the concept of cell matrix interaction and turning on specific signal cascade pathways, they're going to become more interested in it. It's sort of a backwards approach with stem cells, biologists, and differentiation. We're looking at this, we basically see if we can classify it as a stem cell. Then we ask ourselves, what's the mechanism of the differentiation without backing it up and saying, well, rather than going straight to the cell, why don't we see, I guess after we understand the mechanism, I think the newest thing is, can we duplicate or can we mimic that signaling pathway by altering macroscopic conditions,
mm-hmm.
which would simply be an adhesion property. Stick
mm-hmm.
it on collagen as opposed to fibronectin, and I get a five-fold increase in an osteogenic gene, and I get a three-fold decrease in an adipogenic gene.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea of binary cell fate decision, also very important, and that macroscopic conditions are crucial.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's going to become more and more
mm-hmm.
to the forefront, which would allow your kind of your group to maybe model some things. Because we were just talking about it at the break. You can't model this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You can't model a signal transduction pathway when it interacts with five other signal transduction pathways. How can you do that?
You
That's
have a network.
You might
a network. Okay,
yeah.
Well, simple
you
for you.
Just click your Apple click button.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what the models want, is a rich network to model.
Oh, I'm going to have to download it? Better be good. I don't know. It's a free download now. Oh, you know what? Forget about it.
Uncheck
the box.
Okay.
No, No, on the
Have your email again.
I put my email on it?
On the
You got three, I have a fake one.
And get rid of those,
Take Mark B's email.
Okay.
Oh, no, thank you for that, okay, good.
Yeah, it's not my computer.
Congratulations.
Yes.
I think so.
Wait, you
Before you get iTunes.
This isn't worth it, I'm telling you. Any other questions while we're doing this?
Yeah, what's that guy with the
That's the Hulk. Or no, wait, but that's the Fantastic Four, isn't it?
So I was asking, so this view of Steinberg that you can describe, cell splitting, cell attraction,
right.
especially differentiation using say surface tension, is that accepted or not? Because I mean, as he retires, I know one of his
I think it's becoming more accepted because when you're talking about, I don't know what materials he adheres it onto.
So
but
he
again,
wasn't doing any. He was just trying to understand. He showed that if you have a cell population. You know, with a given variable, say the surface tension,
yeah.
so it describes some affinity for other populations, and you mix these all up, that you can track the dynamics of time, and from such an absolutely gross point of view, I mean, it's coarse-grained over all the details, it still, in some cases, is able to describe what they see experimentally, so that's a small handle on the problem.
Yeah, I think it goes back to your idea of strain
yeah,
and stress.
But
how popular
Malcolm's model, which I'm going to talk about tomorrow, is specifically not talking about cell differentiation. In all of the experiments that he does, he takes differentiated populations of cells, and the goal of the experiments is to make sure that the cells don't change their material properties during the lifetime of the experiment.
Can't do it.
That
so
may be, I mean,
thought
he
was
25 years ago.
Well, it's more than that. It was in the 60s, actually. 62 was his first paper on it.
Is the idea
absolutely. I mean, in terms of developmental biology, Nietzsche is central to developmental biology.
I know you say that, but there are many textbooks that claim that viewpoint is incorrect. The standard textbooks haven't adopted
I don't think it's really worth it to adopt from a molecular
Well, we should talk about that. I mean, it depends what standard textbooks you're talking about.
Well,
she didn't have
you know what? I think that sometimes, you know, you're talking about these modeling ideas. And will it become popular? I think you also have to take in mind your audience. The majority of people who look at differentiation are cell biologists, molecular biologists. And this idea of modeling of surface tension, et cetera, at a gross macroscopic scale, I don't want, you know, you would think, oh, it's too simple. For us, it's too complicated. We look at it, it's a whole other mindset of shift. We don't have a background in it. So I think this is why this kind of an idea is great, but I think it should be flipped around the opposite way, and people like me should be sitting in the audience, and you guys should be up here lecturing, and then this way we would have better integration between the two areas, and that kind of a modeling system would become more popular. At this point, it's not popular because nobody understands it. Now, you understand surface tension and this gross kind of this gross modeling scale. It's second nature to you. To me, it's another language. Which is why seminars like this are a really good idea, but let's flip it around the other way.
Right, but nobody comes. I'm above the only
right. We're here.
How much interest do you have in that? I mean,
I have an interest in it. I'm just afraid that I'm not going to understand it.
Exactly.
You know, I'm afraid that I've gotten too old to the point where I can take in new information.
Then you have bad teachers.
Really?
It's
it is,
yeah.
You know, to me, I think of this kind of stuff. Oh, God. It does take a while. Maybe if there was more of an immersion. I have an interest in it because I think it's central to the issue of differentiation. You know, we talk about adding growth factors and compounds and things like that, but then you look at it and say, well, basically it's covalent bonding and divalent cations, and then you were talking about the spatial sequestration of growth factors. These are so many different areas that as they start to pop up, how are we going to integrate them with one another? I think that's the main question. And for me, I worry that I'm not going to understand it.
But if all that was what the brochure was about.
Yeah.
That was what it was, so
integrated.
Yeah.
Came.
Well, it would have been, I don't know how much it went out to the molecular biology community at UCLA, but I know that it would have been, I know more people would have showed up. I don't know how much of an expansion they want to do for next year, But it would be a great idea to contact the molecular biochemistry department and the molecular biology department at UCLA,
mm-hmm.
and even send we have a stem cell institute at
mm-hmm.
UCLA that you could contact the stem cell institute at UCLA.
But I try
and invite people like that to come, and it would be probably a livelier seminar discussion. That's for sure.
Yeah, I try in the East, and then the response is exactly what you say. I'm afraid I won't understand anything. I'm too old to get into differential equations.
Yeah.
Much less into continuum.
Well, one way of getting everybody to show up is making it a good area.
Exactly.
You know, if you have your seminar in Tuscany, people are going to come.
And so it would communicate better if there were more of the other side here.
See, I'll just speak for myself, not for the audience. But one of the difficulties I have is finding a really good problem to work on in the bio area,
mm-hmm.
without it being so specific
mm-hmm.
that I then feel I have to incorporate, you know, all the level of detail. I know
right.
this is what's really going on, and if you want to do drug formulation,
yeah.
or whatever, you have to do. There's no way around it. But it's not what the training has prepared me for. The types of questions that I like to ask. And the only source we have, essentially, are people like you, where you can test some of these ideas out
right.
and see what do you think? What do you think are the big unanswered questions in the field? And then we can see when we formulate
hmm.
it. And, you know,
yeah.
But it's the questions somehow that are missing. I can read thousands of papers, but I never come away with, if you had to prioritize in cell differentiation, you know, the top three problems, what are they?
Mm-hmm.
That would be tremendously.
Yeah, you're right. Nobody does. And I was saying this just on the break. A lot of the times I get questions about, I'm not an expert in signal transduction. I've learned in looking at my pathways, I've educated myself on one or two signal transduction pathways. And I get people who ask me questions about other signal transduction pathways. We tend to pigeonhole ourselves. This is my area. I work in adipose-derived stem cells. I'm interested in bone and cartilage formation, and I want to see how the MAPK pathway does that. But so I've pigeonholed myself into that. But you're right, there aren't a lot of people who look at the big picture of differentiation. You can look up review articles, and even review articles are specific to one particular problem. But I think the idea of saying, okay, if you had to prioritize the top three problems of differentiation, that in itself is a really hard question.
Right.
Just thinking about it, I myself, what would be the top three problems of differentiation? Well, for me, the number one problem of differentiation is translating what we know in vitro to what we know in vivo. Because it's, who cares if I can form bone on a dish? Until I can take a stem cell and get it to differentiate and heal a complicated fracture in a femur, it doesn't matter. Who cares if I can get it to form a nerve on a dish?
Mm-hmm.
If I can't put it into somebody's brain with Parkinson's and get improved cerebral function, it's really, so that to me, that's the number one problem. Translating what we know in vitro to the in vivo situation. And now you're going from a 2D, you're going from a 2D, yeah, 2D to a 3D system, and that's the number one problem. Going from a 2D
yep.
to a 3D
yep.
system.
Yep.
In vitro is 2D. We
yep.
can even make it somewhat in 3D, but when we go to the in vivo, which we eventually have to do, we're dealing with a complex three-dimensional environment. And how do you replicate that in an incubator, and how do you even model that on a piece of paper?
So let me try and answer that question. Because
you're eager, you're standing up.
Yeah, that's why I want to get some attention.
The
last question, and it's an engineering problem there. An engineer is founded on, you know, the basic sciences, physics, chemistry, and mathematics competition. So you start with a traditional view of the world and all the traditional materials of metal, ceramics, plastics, semiconductors, and composites. That's all this stuff you see around us, except us. And we're lipids, sugars, amino acids,
yeah.
and salt and water. Well, once you start there, and now you develop design methodologies. You reverse engineer the problems nature solved, which is how to, you could phrase this whole thing you presented with, how did nature solve the problem of duplicating cells? And that becomes a problem, and now engineers can start thinking about it. And using traditional design methodology to go from define the function, material selection, and analysis of the design, do the materials meet that specification, draw the blueprint, production methods, prototype is evolution, and then performance in service, and then you quantify that. And we can do that at every scale, the macro, micro, and nano scales, the receptors you talk about, the cells you talk about, the organs you talk about. So that's really how it happens, or how it has to happen now, is for people like Farsh Gilad, you know, that are making these adipose-derived stem cells, and
he's
planting them. Yeah, he's coming from one of the And then, but anyways, it's an engineering problem. What you described as an engineering problem where the biologists can lay the catalog foundation, the physicists and chemists that are now biochemists, biophysicists, bioengineers, are now layering the science of that design scheme, and then the true bona fide engineers are developing the products and processes that create, you know, the new bond.
But when I look at the engineering, I don't know.
I'm probably gonna get slapped
for this, but sometimes maybe it's a good thing. Sometimes I think engineers tend to oversimplify, and maybe I'm probably gonna have things thrown at me for that.
Yeah, that's good.
But when you're looking at the in vivo system,
sure, that's fine.
It's an extremely. I look at it and say, Mike, that is an extremely complicated system. It's an extremely, but maybe the engineer, from his or her standpoint, can reduce it down to a couple very simple principles.
Have you lifted the hood of your car?
Oh, for God's sakes, no.
Well,
that's why I have a mechanic.
Right. So
but then that's an idea of, again, collaboration. The fields have expanded so vastly over the years. There's no way I can step back as a molecular biologist and now begin to retrain and reorganize my brain as an engineer.
Nobody's asking you to.
But I could go to you and say, hey,
right.
Let's collaborate and let's
so
do this.
Nobody's asking you to do that. They're asking you to join in a discussion, which is a design team,
yeah,
where everybody brings their discipline.
Actually, I'm asking for your top three priorities.
Top
what
three priorities? Top, okay, what I say, translating
so
in vitro
the
to in vivo.
In vitro, second one was
2D to 3D.
Right,
yeah, 2D to 3D, understanding how 2D to 3D, isn't that enough? So going from, 2D to 3D, in vitro, and really 2D to 3D, in vitro to in vivo sort of correlate with one another.
And the multi-scale thing, you know, that's the, because 3D, the cells is 3D, and you call it 2D just because macroscopically you are thinking about E2D, but when you change the scale from the micrometer or nanometer, you know, then that's 3D.
Exactly.
And that's, you know.
Yeah. So there's two.
Is that called multi-scale?
Three, you know, what would I prioritize for the third one? You know, I'd like to say, again, I'm trying to avoid the signal transduction type of thing, because that's just too complicated. I don't think we're ever really going to know, but that's two out of three. I think those are two pretty big issues that are made up of several minor problems. You had your hand up.
I want to come back to what Dave just said, have you looked at what's under the hood of your car.
There's an engine?
A couple of years back, a biologist actually wrote an article that said, can a biologist repair a radio? That was a very serious issue in this article, and that was an issue of language. A radio is a very, very complicated machine. And you wonder how a person that gets trained just for a year or so is actually able to repair radios. How can he be so extremely smart?
Yeah.
The reason is because he has an extraordinarily efficient language. He knows secrets. He knows what these things do. And the biologist was a bit making fun of the thing, how a biologist would open the radio and would identify various things, and this thing triggers this thing, and this thing triggers that thing. But without the understanding of the idea of electricity, circuits, oscillators, and stuff like this, you would probably never really understand what this is about. So the question is it clear or is it not clear that in this field, for instance, the molecular cell biology, biochemistry, that we do have the right language, or we don't have the right language? Is there something we're missing? Are we looking too specific?
Well, I think we just determined today that our languages are so different. When I talk about activation,
there's one thing, for instance, if you use circuits and so on, there's Ohm's law, there are equations, there's mathematics behind this. There's comparatively little mathematics currently going on in
biology.
Biology, basically,
yeah,
in general. But all these cascades, you translate, you can model them in the sense their binding constant, their reaction rates, and so on. The question is, would we learn something, or would we even do more of the oversight? So, for me, this is a question, because as a physicist, I try to be rigorous in general and quantitative.
Yeah, yeah.
But the question is always, can I do this? Can I expect anything like this in this field? Because I'd usually be told, no, everything is specific, trust me on that. And as a physicist, I've learned that there's generality, there's universality, but maybe I'm expecting it in the wrong place. This is like a clash of culture thing that we're
Yeah, you're right. And to be honest, if you go to any university, one of the smallest departments are going to be biomathematics. Biology and math, for some reason, they don't mesh well together. Chemistry and math, thermodynamics, you know, physics and math are almost hand. What did they used to say? Chemistry is physics is math. It's the biologists that are the standalone people. And you want to know why we're standalone?
Because
we hated math in university. We hated it. We looked at it and we went, if I took a thermodynamics course, I thought I'd be a chemist like my husband. I'm going to chemistry. I walked into a thermodynamics course, picked up the textbook, saw all differential calculus, closed the textbook, walked out, went, all right, that's it. I'm going to go into biology. We hate math. And that's why we're biologists. Maybe not really. I don't know. It's also an innate understanding. I honestly don't think I have the innate understanding of this kind of stuff up on the board, which is why I'm a biologist.
But it gets to a point that we need a quantitative understanding of what we are
do
doing.
Do we? It goes up twofold. That's all.
If you go and read the literature and are objective about, you will realize immediately that the immense majority of the publications that are now published on this field are almost like an artifact of the experiment and a setup. It's like an art, you know, you have this artist that want to have this beautiful result and then just do the tricks that they learn to do it. But when it get to the real time of giving a drug to a patient, you just need to know the rate limiting, you
yep.
need the quantities, you need the
yep.
timing, you need a lot of quantitative.
And sometimes that's
that
the problem. Well, that's the problem, my experience, when I bring biology together with working with a bunch of surgeons.
Mm-hmm.
And I work with a bunch of surgeons. Surgeons don't care. My old boss used to say, don't tell me I'm a glorified tailor. For God's sakes, keep it simple. I'm a surgeon. So I've learned to say, okay, if I do this, I do this, and this will form bone. Clinicians don't care how I get to the bone forming stage, and they don't care about the mathematics that underlie these principles of signal transduction. They just want a drug and a scaffold and a cell. They want to suck something out of somebody in an OR, stick it in this, put it in there, and 6 weeks later, they've got, I mean, they are the ultimate in reductionists. This is the problem, and this is the solution I want. Don't tell me how you get there. Just get me the solution.
Yeah, but they are the one that they get a bunch of tests and the CO2 pressure
yeah.
is high and everything.
But that's a different kind of numbers.
Very narrow limits they had to act. So the quantitative question are always.
But to them, quantitation is just dose. This is the range I can use.
We care what they want to know. I mean,
you're going to care when you develop Parkinson's disease at 65 years of age and you can't stand without turning. You know, we all say, oh, you know, we all sit here on our little high horses. Oh, we're so much smart. But you know what? It all comes down. I always looked at science as two things. Learning, I started off in looking at endocytosis and RAB-GTPases, and they said, well, what the heck does that really matter? Well, if you realize that the formation of fatty plaques in Alzheimer's has to do with endocytic mechanisms, there's learning for the sake of learning. But here at UCLA, particularly working with the hospital, we're always pushed to say, yeah, it's really cool to learn for the sake of learning, but how does it solve or how does it improve the human condition? I mean, ultimately, isn't that why we're all here? We want to improve the human condition. What's the point of learning and researching and studying?
But you're asking questions that you just said the surgeon is interested in. Mm-hmm. You'd like to know how does it happen? How can we improve it? If you don't ask these how and why questions,
right.
you just give me the kit and
yeah.
I'm going to apply.
That's the surgeon. Give me the kit,
yeah.
let me apply.
But that's not our approach.
Right.
That's
right.
not the approach of anyone sitting in the
Right, exactly. Board. We want to know how and why. Definitely.
And
so does a molecular biologist.
The surgeons couldn't do half of what they do were not for the development of the microscope,
right.
oscilloscopes,
exactly.
and
oh,
all exa- the tools
yeah,
they
exactly.
use.
Oh, exactly.
Exactly. There is so much money being wasted. There is so much money being wasted in these clinical trials, which are that trial, almost like trial and error.
That's what they
an
are.
Get an idea of this drug that
mm-hmm.
is going to work, and then you spend millions upon millions upon millions trying to see.
It is trial and error.
Can we get back to more cells and materials?
No, but what I'm saying is
yeah.
there a predictive way to deal with this drug of material?
Yeah,
right.
Well,
in
yeah.
Let's get back to his point, which was really good about the language and the vocabulary and concepts. You have many, many words up here which we have a physical or chemical underlying principle for. One word was proteoglycans, which we don't understand, but cushioning we do.
Mm-hmm.
And so the cushioning mechanism, though, you know it's a cushioning material. Well, it's because we have a lot of pressure. It's now water-bound.
Yeah, it's water.
And, right. But that now that word cushioning, you know, it's an engineering word, it's a physics word, it, you just sat on it. So, you know, there's a mechanism under your butt here, which is actually happening in a cushioning way. And then this proteoglycan, these same things. So we do have these concepts, and it's the task is to not necessarily change the words, but understand what the words mean in these physical and chemical senses. And so that's why I said interaction and action don't mean anything to us, because we don't have the mechanisms of deep interaction. It's a word you use, and you have to use it because that describes what happens. But it doesn't tell you that this receptor does this, and it's the property of the alpha helical coils,
yeah,
which stiffer, that
right,
allow it to actually have a scissor movement,
right,
for example. And if that's all it is, that's all we're saying we need to know. Now, so the interaction now of the ligand changes the conformation, produces, you know, the activation. You know, interaction, activation, it's actually, you know, if you have a handicapped door, you push on this, like you said, the door opens. There's a mechanism there that does that, and there's materials involved in the
mm-hmm.
processes. That's all we're looking to
yeah.
get out of this, that's cells and materials.
It's going to be difficult to teach each other one language.
It's all right, it's not that difficult.
Yeah.
But you can answer the third question about what you're interested in for development, and that is, what sequence of signals of what type do I have to give to a cell to
yeah.
get it to differentiate in a particular way, to be functional in a particular
yeah.
way?
Yeah, but that's actually a complicated question.
Oh, I know,
yeah.
but that's
why it's number three.
But that's what,
yeah.
but that's your primary interest.
Yeah, and what's strange is that we, maybe engineers go from the top down, or we go from the bottom up. We look at the extremely complicated picture and try to figure that out, try to figure out how we're going to put all these pieces together in the jigsaw puzzle to get the picture. So we start off by looking at these complicated signal transduction pathways and figuring out how they interact with each other to translate, so we can understand how the 3D and the 2D environment interact with, or how they relate to one another, to understand how the in vitro and the in vivo. I don't know which is more complicated or which is less complicated, but it is a language. I tell my students when I teach anatomy, it's a language. And once you learn the language, it's a piece of cake. But it's going to involve, and I'll leave off by saying this, it's going to involve a fundamental radical shift in thinking in biologists. And a lot of biologists are hesitant to make that sea change shift in thinking because they hated math. And that's why they're biologists. So right now, collaborations are probably the way to go. But it'll be an interesting area to see if we can actually take all these areas and can distill it into one super scientist that understands all of these things. You know, as a tissue engineer, I collaborate with Ben Wu all the time, who's a scaffold guy, he's a materials engineer, and I thought when I sent off a K-1 grant to the NIH, wouldn't it be really cool if I could acquire that knowledge? Wouldn't it make me a more efficient tissue engineer if I understood not only the biology of the stem cell, but the physics of the support that I'm going to put it on? Apparently the NIH didn't
they
agree with
it.
They rejected it.
That's the case.
Yeah.
If you try to do it, you get...
You know what they said to me
stuff.
In my summary statements?
Yeah.
You could just go to an engineer and have them make the scaffolds. Why is it important that you learn how to make them?
It's so outrageous, some of those comments, you know, that I should have, you know, had the collection of
isn't it
comments.
Nice to know that I could go to my neighborhood engineer and say, I need this. But then that assumes that the engineer understands what I'm trying to get at and will know exactly what kind of material and coating and adhesion properties. And that's, I think, the problem. That's why seminars like this may actually change the scope of our fields, because we're going to begin to realize that no man is an island. It isn't enough that I just know this part of my work. If I want to truly become an efficient tissue engineer, I'm going to have to learn this and this. And it is. It honestly is being resisted right now.
And JVC is the same thing, you know, unless you have like you know, the typical, the JVC is like the journal that we all look at the most scientific.
I've published in the Journal of Biological Chemistry.
Yeah, I do.
I love,
but lately,
yeah.
And of course they're doing the type of thing that they like now.
Oh, I hope
know,
so.
Say, not from
I'm going to send one out to
but anything that is more quantitative or modeling,
yeah,
now
it's resistant.
It's just now not being taken,
yeah.
as they did a few years back. It has been taken over by...
They want to promote the collaboration, but that's assuming that the two collaborators speak the same language. So wouldn't it be really cool if we could just make one scientist that's bilingual in both languages?
It's called graduate school.
But even graduate school doesn't. Even graduate school tends to make it a lot more specific.
No,
I mean, here you are now in the center,
and
you're a long-haired graduate.
Not these graduate schools, the new graduate schools.
Good.